This morning, I wanted to share my conversation with Todd Snyder. His new album includes a song, Handsome John, that Todd wrote in memory of his hero slash mentor slash surrogate father, John Prine. We will hear the song and we will hear Todd talk about the song and about himself and, of course, a lot about John. The album is called First Agnostic Church of Hope and Wonder, and Todd describes the concept as a house of worship that's presided over by, as he says, a phony preacher. And when everyone starts to realize it, he asks God to help, and God does, proving once and for all that God is hilarious. And I pointed out that Todd has said about himself that he decided to stop making up songs because there wasn't anything to say. And as soon as he realized that, he felt like he could finally start writing. So I asked Todd, are you the preacher and God helped you by letting you somehow continue what you're doing?
Yeah, nobody has caught that yet. But yes, that's what I thought it was, trying to find meaning in existing and then coming to the notion that there isn't any, I suppose, is freeing. Or the notion that there might not be any, for me, makes it easier to work, not have any grandioseness behind it.
Is that how you used to feel, that you were dealing in grandiose sorts of topics?
Well, maybe just more like, this is going to sound like I think way too much about it, but language is a deceitful thing. It's kind of a trick. It doesn't really work. You can't describe everything with it. And so I started thinking of myself as someone who traded in letters, and that it was just a shell game. There's not really anything to say. There's not really a truth to uncover or share. You're just spewing words. And sometimes that makes it easier for me to say more. For some crazy reason, the notion that it doesn't matter makes it easier to approach than this notion that I'm going to make up some song that's going to help a bunch of people. If that happens, that's great. But sitting down to do that is silly.
You have some very touching songs on this album, including Handsome John, which you wrote for John Prine. Given what you just said, would you say that you wrote them more for your own healing than to communicate with others?
I appreciate that. That's a cool question. Maybe so. And that one just fell out, too. Like, I tried to stay out of its way. But yeah, and in the beginning, it was always more about helping myself get over the girl that broke up with me, or maybe get the last word in the song or something. And then the older I get, the less I have of that.
You said you're grateful at times like this to have an outlet where you can sing. How is it that playing songs helps to heal you?
That's the first thing that I found when I learned a couple of chords, was that you could make up your own song and give yourself a pep talk or tell people that you cared about them. And you didn't even have to say it to them. You could just do it in your room. And it felt a lot like later in life, I would go to see shrinks and I'd say, this was a lot of what the guitar did at the beginning. The guitar would listen to you. And I always told myself I never wanted it to be something besides that. Like if ever somebody offered me a book or some money, it would have to not change that part of it. And then when I was 30 or 31, I really got tempted to let go of that part of it for, I guess, probably more glory than money. But I was 30. I was having a blast. I liked to party when we toured. I always was just as excited about the after party as the show. These days, I'm a little too tired.
You have that line in Handsome John. He was nearly 50 and I was only a kid. And you have songs for other mentors who are also a generation older, like Jerry Jeff Walker and Billy Joe Shaver. I've interviewed you a few times, and you've talked about the difficult relationship you've had with your own father. Did having these men in your life help make up for any of that?
Yeah, and my dad passed away right when I got, while I was making my first album, so he wasn't around for any of it. And I think John Prine was the first person to take me into his camp and helped me a lot, because when you first start making records, you get criticized a lot. You don't see that coming, but even your own friends and stuff, it just, you think it's going to be this great, you're going to be the prom queen or whatever, but it's kind of a beating. The sound man at the club doesn't care about the new people. It's a rude awakening, and he was there to help me with my ego in the very beginning. And Jerry Jeff Walker, too. Both of them, anytime I felt like I was getting my head up my own butt, they would both try to say, this is about traveling. This is about having fun. That's the end of it. And I got to tour with Ramblin' Jack Elliott last year, and he says the same thing. If you're in this for something besides the travel and the good times, you're making a mistake. And if you try to make more of it, you're making a mistake. It's all grab ass. That's what he said. And those guys in Shaver, too, they're like, this isn't an occupation. It's a vocation. It's an adventure. You're not going to pile up a bunch of money, but you're going to be on a yacht someday and probably not even remember it, you know, because you get to go and get in the world like a sock in a dryer, and it becomes high adventure. And if you report back, people let you keep doing it.
The first time you ever heard John, you said, this guy speaks to me and this is who I want to be. Can you put into words what it is that makes him so beloved to other songwriters?
I think he's like the Hank Williams of my time, and especially this generation behind me. I have to wonder, like everyone else, if I knew how he did it, I'd do it. But I sometimes think that not only was he incredibly compassionate, but he also didn't seem to be driven by a brass ring. And I hope to think I'm one of the many people that that resonated with, was a fan. This guy's not preaching to me, but again, I can only speak as a fan, as a songwriter. If I knew what he was doing, I'd do it.
What did you mean when you said nobody's ever been more vulnerable with me?
It was on a few levels when I was young. I think he saw me about two records in. I was trying to steel myself up to what was happening, and it was showing up in the songs. I was using them to win arguments. I was using them to declare that you hadn't knocked me down. I don't know why, because it's a phase where you're getting clapped for a lot, but for some reason it feels like you're getting punched a lot, and it takes a minute to figure out. And he was really open with me about how he had been through that phase and that I had to get out of it fast. I remember I had made three records and I was getting ready to make my fourth one, and I had 13 songs, and John and I were really getting close at that time, and I gave him the 13 songs, and 2 days later I saw him. I said, what'd you think? He says, you got a really good song there. And I said, just one? He said, yeah. And that was the beginning of him saying, you're using this for the wrong reason. And one of the words he used was that none of this is vulnerable. You're winning all these songs. You're talking about stuff where you don't feel like you're winning. You're trying to talk yourself into thinking that you are. It could have been a shrink. Those 13 songs, I kept one. It was called Missing You. It was on a record called Happy to Be Here. And that was the only song. And then the rest I wrote new. I threw out the others. And I've always used his style ever since, which is, it's got to have a heart in it. If it doesn't, it's just a weapon.
When Handsome John was first released, his widow Fiona hadn't heard it yet, and you were nervous about what she would think. What did she think?
She loved it. She made me really happy. That's such a good family. And Old Boy Records is going to keep going. I think his sons are going to keep that label going. He's such a sweet man. Before he died, I mean, well before he died, like, not because he knew he was dying. All the records I made from him and the publishing that he had, after his manager died, he just gave it all back to me. Totally unheard of. Everybody whose records he had, as soon as his manager didn't need that money anymore and his wife was taken care of, John just gave everybody that stuff back. Labels never, ever, ever do that. I was shocked. I thought he was trying to sell it to me. I'm like, okay, I guess. I'll try to see if I got any dough. And he's like, who's talking dough?
You actually don't give yourself enough credit, because you say in the song that you didn't know him as well as you tell everybody you did. But I know that when he died, Fiona called you to tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved him so much, and I know that he loved me a lot. Our relationship was so mentor-student that I never could really totally calm down or punch him in the shoulder or go watch a ball game. I was always pretty... He's not the person who makes people nervous, but I was so enamored and so trying to learn that it was probably almost annoying when I was around for him, because he could feel this uber fan just like, wow, look how he eats those French fries. I just love him. His manager, Albanetta, who's gone too, they both treated me like their son, which means they also would roll their eyes, which I needed. Somebody has to do that to a young person with a record contract.
You tell a story about being hired to chauffeur him around when he was making the Missing Years, and he tells you he's starting a record label, and you say, I'm going to be on it, and you both laugh. But 8 years later, it came to be. How?
Isn't that funny? So as soon as I got a record contract, I called him and his manager, and they started mentoring me right then. And the first three records, I kind of felt like I wouldn't say I got off track, but I just got really blurry. And he was the one that came in. Like the third record, I tanked the whole release party. After the release party, they wanted me to go to like a mental home, not even a rehab. And John just said, well, come work for us, because it was also driving me crazy because I'm a folk singer, you know, and that record company was looking for a singer. And we got along good, but it came to a head at the release party. And I remember after that party, nobody wanted anything to do with me at all because I had just been so rude, I guess. I don't remember it. John has a video of it. I've never seen it. He said it was great if it had stopped a minute and a half sooner. And that's how he looks at stuff, too. It's like too many verses. Other than that, great tune.
Thank you.
Todd Snyder, Handsome John, his song for John Prine from his new album, First Agnostic Church of Hope and Wonder. I wanted to play one more little snippet of my conversation with Todd and then John Prine's Lake Marie. In Handsome John, you heard Todd reference lots of John's song titles and his Oh Boy record label. And he mentions in the song how John would dance off stage at the end of a concert to Lake Marie. And I told Todd that I had read where Todd had said, younger people dance because they're excited about how pretty they feel. Older people are just over giving a damn what they look like. And I asked Todd where he is on that spectrum.
I'm the older scale and have been for a while. That's what I think the Grateful Dead did for the country, was they taught young people to dance like old people. They danced not with each other, but with a gratitude. They kind of just face the band and run in place. And it feels like deep gratitude. That's why I see older women dancing. I'm like, that's as happy as people get.
Maybe it came with being free and saying, my songwriting doesn't have to reveal any great truths. Maybe that's what lets you dance with abandon.
I see them as similar. I think that dancing is the main thing music does, because it lets you let go of your inhibitions, and it feels good to just flail around without concern for what other people, just with joy, and you don't care who's watching. It's liberating, like jumping into cold water.
Along the Illinois-Wisconsin border, there was this Indian tribe. They found two babies in the woods, white babies. One of them was named Elizabeth. She was the fairer of the two, while the smaller and more fragile one was named Marie. Having never seen white girls before, and living on the two lakes, known as the Twin Lakes, they named the larger and more beautiful lake, Lake Elizabeth. And thus the smaller lake that was hidden from the highway became known forever as Lake Marie.
We were standing, standing by peaceful waters.
Many years later, I found myself talking to this girl who was standing there with her back turned to Lake Marie. The wind was blowing, especially through her hair. There was four Italian sausages cooking on the outdoor grill, and they was sizzling. Many years later, we found ourselves in Canada trying to save our marriage and perhaps catch a few fish. But whatever came first, that night she fell asleep in my arms, humming the tune to Louie Louie. Oh, baby, we gotta go now. Were biking as the cars were parking, the loon sharks were sharking, the necks were narking. Practically everyone was there in the parking lot by the forest preserve, The police had found two bodies. Nay, naked bodies. Their faces had been horribly disfigured by some sharp object. Saw it on the news. The TV news. In a black and white video. You know what blood looks like in a black and white video? Shadows. Shadows! That's what it looks like. All the love we shared between her and me was slammed. Slammed up against the banks of old Lake Marie. Marie! We were standing. Standing by peaceful waters. Oh, baby. We gotta go now.
John Prine, Lake Marie, and Todd Snyder.